You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Welcome to this second panel. We're going to be exploring Arctic and diplomacy in this panel. My name is David Stephen. I'm a non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings. I work in foreign policy. I'm actually non-resident everywhere these days. I work on the Managing Global Order Initiative, and at MGO, our research explores the implications of a range of 21st century challenges for the global order. And the Arctic is of interest to us for three main reasons. First, it's a region that has undergone an extraordinarily rapid transition from a zone of Cold War competition through a brief period where it was mainly forgotten, as we've heard, to an arena where a large number of states, both large and small, both within the Arctic and far away from the Arctic, are contending with a set of unfamiliar risks and opportunities. Second, because the Arctic is a harbinger of the way that climate will reshape the global order, with the loss of ice that has been much faster than many, almost all observers, expected, and that has triggered a series of consequences that have security, economic, energy, and, of course, environmental dimensions. A man-made ocean in the Arctic, or effectively a man-made ocean in the Arctic, is an indicator of the other changes that we're going to have to deal with in the decades to come in a world where climate forces the pace of change, whether or not governments are ready for it. And third, and I think most relevant for this session, is the way in which the Arctic is already demanding that we think afresh about the way that we do foreign policy. Some initially assumed that the Arctic was going to ask questions of governments that they would be prove unable to answer. But as Martin Indyk said in his opening remarks, the midterm report is actually fairly encouraging. It provides us with a sense of cautious optimism, and that is a credit to the many diplomats who have worked on the challenge. But in the next decade, the Arctic will gain ever greater strategic significance. It will attract increasingly powerful financial interests. It will draw the attention of a world that believes that the Arctic has iconic status and should be protected. And, of course, it will involve the population of the Arctic in a profound economic, political, and cultural transformation. I think diplomats are playing a game that has the opposite dynamic of the game of chess. In chess, as the game goes on, you remove pieces from the board. The strategic challenge becomes, it's hard, but it becomes clearer. In the Arctic and in climate politics more generally, you start with the core players on the board, and over time, pieces rush onto the board to defend their interests. The game becomes ever more complex. The strategy becomes ever more difficult. We have an illustrious panel here who are already playing this game and can help us understand the challenges it poses. I'm not going to list all of their many accomplishments. You have biographies in front of you, in your pack, with you. But we have Julie Gourley, the senior Arctic official at the U.S. Department of State. We have Christian Seis, the Deputy Secretary General at Norway's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We have Patrick Borby, President of the Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency. And we have Ambassador Holm, who has, for me, I'm a Brit, as you can probably hear from the accent, and I grew up in the south of England in a place where snow happened almost never. And Ambassador Holm has, for me, a very romantic job title. He is the Kingdom of Denmark's Ambassador to the Arctic. I'm going to ask each of the three speakers to make a brief initial intervention. And then I may ask a few follow-up questions, and then we'll open it to the floor, and we'll try and give as much time as possible for questions from the floor. I'm going to ask them to organize their initial intervention around the following questions. Firstly, what can we learn from the last decade of diplomacy in the Arctic, and what do they think are the major challenges for diplomats over the next decade? Two, what do they see as the role of the Arctic Council with regard to energy oversight, both today and in the future? And three, how do they see the relationship evolving between the Arctic Council's member states, its permanent participants, its observers, and the many state and state non-state actors who do not have a formal relationship with the Council but see themselves as having a stake in the Arctic's future? So one question about what we've learned from the past, and what that tells us about the future. One more specifically about energy in the Arctic Council, and one about the many, many players who are interested in Arctic diplomacy. I'm going to go in the order in the programme, so Ms. Gawley first, then Mr. Seiss, Mr. Borby, and Ambassador Holm. So, Julie, over to you.
Thank you, David. Those are all very interesting questions. What can we learn from diplomacy and where we've been in the past and where we're going in the future? I think from a U.S. perspective, we have seen a dramatic increase in importance in the Arctic to the United States and to the world. That's clear, I think, to everyone because of the interest being shown by lots of countries and lots of NGOs and IGOs who are interested in coming to the Arctic Council as observers. I would say that our diplomacy has improved dramatically as well. The eight Arctic states are very close to one another. We're very friendly. The U.S. and Russia have a particularly good relationship in the Arctic. And as our diplomacy with Russia rises and falls and is positive and has some stumbling blocks over time, as we've seen all of us over our lifetimes, the Arctic is one area where we always are strong in our relationship with Russia. We do very well. Russia very much values their relationship with us in the Arctic. Even during the Cold War, a lot of our domestic agencies in both countries worked very closely together. So, but the Arctic Council has done a lot, actually, to bring all of the Arctic states closer together. And it's grown in importance because of the fact that it is a unique experiment. We do have indigenous people with us, sitting at the table with us, making decisions with us. It's a very important forum, and I think in the United States it will grow in importance as the region will. The relationship of the member states and the permanent participants with the observer countries and the non-state actors and the countries that want to come in, that's a subject I think that is misunderstood in the public. We have a sort of difficult political process for bringing new observers into the council. It wasn't always that way. When the council was born in 1996, there were a number of countries that were already observing and a number of NGOs and IGOs, and we used to grandfather them in. It was very simple. But as the region has grown in importance and in global focus, the process of admitting new entities, states, NGOs, and IGOs, has become more difficult, more challenging, for a number of reasons. One, the Arctic Council is a small and friendly forum. It's a forum, not an international organization, so it has a bit less of a formal structure than international organizations do, and that's by design, and it works very well. And I don't think any of us want to see that good relationship and that good balance among the Arctic states disrupted in any way. So we're being very careful as a group of countries in who we choose to let in. Certainly there are lots of countries and lots of organizations that have legitimate Arctic interests and should be in the room with us when we talk about the Arctic. But there's also, I think, confusion in some corners about what the Arctic Council does and what its role is versus other international bodies with jurisdiction in the Arctic, such as the International Maritime Organization and other parts of the UN, for example. So it's a difficult balance right now. The bigger the Arctic Council gets, the dynamic changes a little bit. So we're being very cautious and very careful, and I think that's understandable. But I think the relationship between the Council and the member states, the permanent participants, and the outside world is a good one and a positive one, and I think it will continue to be that way. It just may move a little bit differently than it has in the past. But I see the Arctic Council growing in importance, getting stronger over time. Certainly the United States values it very highly and will continue to. Secretary Clinton was very interested in the Arctic and in the Council. Secretary Kerry hasn't been around very long yet, but I think we can assume he will be as well. So I will stop there.
Okay. Just to briefly follow up on that with you. 2015, quite a big year for the US and climate and the Arctic. You'll be in the chair of the Arctic Council. It's also the year that the world has said that yet again it will try and set targets on climate change to come in, emissions to come into force in 2020. Secretary Kerry, as you said, is likely to be an active participant in Arctic diplomacy and will clearly be a strong and active participant in climate diplomacy. How do you see what the US is doing in the Arctic relating to the broader climate diplomacy picture? And also, just one small question. Do you think we will see Secretary Kerry at the Arctic Council in May?
On the first question, because the impacts of climate change are so dramatic in the Arctic, and as we've heard already from a number of speakers today, the sea ice and the glaciers and the Greenland ice sheet are melting much faster than climate models have predicted, and the permafrost is thawing more quickly, and that's a huge, huge problem for climate change with the release of carbon and dioxide and methane in particular. The focus on the Arctic in the global climate debate seems to me to be increasing. And there are certain aspects of climate change that are particularly relevant in the Arctic. Short-lived climate forcers, or short-lived climate pollutants, as we now call them, are an area that the Council has focused a lot of attention on because things like black carbon and methane and tropospheric ozone have particular impact in the Arctic. And the Council, outside of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, has tried to take some action on mitigating the effects of these pollutants, particularly black carbon, because we think that if the Arctic states, at least, who some of whom are major emitters of things like black carbon, can reduce their emissions in the Arctic region, and hopefully countries that are close to the Arctic would follow suit, we may be able to actually buy some time in slowing down the melting and thawing of the cryosphere. So the Arctic Council, I think, is playing a larger role in the global climate debate precisely because of the impacts being much larger and more focused in the Arctic than in other parts of the world, but also because we have opportunities to actually, as a group of countries, take some real action that could have real effect. We don't know yet if Secretary Kerry will go to Kiruna. We hope so. I think the decision will be made very soon. But certainly, whether he's there or not, we will have a very strong delegation. And stay tuned. I think we'll know pretty soon whether he's going to go.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm going to turn it over to you now, Christian.
Thanks very much, David. I understand indeed that you're a non-resident because you were non-resident up in New York here the other day as well when we met last, so that's very good indeed. And you were good leading that debate as well. I would like to make two points. First, just reiterating some of the big drivers behind what we're talking about now. First of all, climate change that everyone has talked about already. In September last year, Arctic Sea was at a record low. And that will probably continue then. But the other driver is, of course, the immense appetite worldwide for energy. Those would be the two big drivers. But also, let us remind ourselves, even though that is not the primary focus of this debate, the fishery resources, which are enormously rich in the northern areas as well, and they are well administered as well. But then you will see that there are some major drivers than climate, energy, other resources as well. And add to that the shipping lanes that would then open up increasingly and at a much faster pace than we perhaps thought, both for the Northeast Passage, but perhaps also in the long run, the Northwest Passage north of Canada and Alaska. So anyway, that would be my first point. The second point is just reminding ourselves as well that we're not talking about the Antarctica. This is not a continent, you know, surrounded by sea that would be sea surrounded by nation states. That's what we're talking about in the Arctic. From time to time, I don't think anyone has actually mentioned that word here, but from time to time I hear the race to the Arctic, that there should be some kind of overarching competition, be that even military, I don't know, in the longer run. But I simply take issue on that. I don't agree with that at all, and I don't think that's what we're seeing in the Arctic Council. Quite to the contrary, as a matter of fact. Quite to the contrary. This is an area organized and characterized by international cooperation and international law. That was established quite clearly also in what is known as the Ilulissat Declaration from May of 2008, where all the littoral states accepted that the UN Convention on Law of the Seas should be the overriding document, that should be the international force that should organize activities in the Arctic. And the United States adhere to that as well, even though, of course, you haven't formally adhere to the treaty. I was very happy to hear the Admiral's word here on the United States government viewpoint on that, but I understand that that is a difficult issue. Add to that, the United Nations Commission on the Limits of the Continental Shelf, another important legal document that applies to these areas as well. It is not a race. Norway and Russia decided in 2010 on the delimitation of our borders at sea. In other words, this is not a sort of space void of international legal order. We believe as well that the petroleum resources that could be found in the Arctic would be in areas that are under national jurisdiction. So, but secondly, and a more practical viewpoint would be that it wouldn't might quite make sense with it for this area to be sort of a place of international tough line competition. Quite to the contrary, if one should utilize the resources in this area, what is needed is not, I mean, it's cooperation. We're talking about enormously complicated areas, be that, well, ice, the sea, darkness, far away from markets. What is called for here is, of course, cooperation. Well, anyway, summing up then the legal and political structures are there, and the Arctic Council is a wonderful instrument, even though it's intergovernmental, in organizing that structure as well. And then, finally, leading up to your questions. What have we learned over the past decade? Well, I'm sure we have learned many, many things, and new things as well, particularly on the way that the climate is changing. But we have at least learned, seen from the Norwegian point of view, and perhaps all of us will agree on that, that the Arctic Council structure works. That we've learned. When it also comes to the Arctic Council, there are eight member states as of now. My country is interesting in accepting new states as permanent observers. We believe that is a good thing, to have them in. This should be the international organization where all issues are being discussed. That's a good thing. And hopefully then, at the Kiruna Ministerial in a month's time, with or without Secretary Kerry, perhaps hopefully we can then decide on new states adhering to the Arctic Council as permanent observers. That's a good thing. Thank you.
Just to come back on that, I mean, we've heard quite a lot of calls for more participation by observers. What do you see as the obstacles to that happening? Why isn't that happening now? And maybe I can ask you to say a little bit more about the role of Russia. I think the people who saw a race in the Arctic saw it through a Cold War lens. They saw Russia there, and they assumed that this would lead to a conflictual relationship. But it has been a zone of considerable cooperation. What has Russia's role been in driving that cooperation?
Well, first, the legal basis is clear and should be quite clear to everyone engaged in our cooperation that this is not an area void of international legal order. Quite to the contrary. It is strictly regulated according to, well, primarily under the United Nations Convention on Law of the Seas. And that should apply and should be understood clearly by present and future permanent observers as well. So I think that's the sort of short answer to your first question. On the second question, on Russia, our experience there is, as a matter of fact, that Russia adheres and believes strongly in the international legal order in the Arctic area. I know that there might be raised criticism against the Russian Federation in some other areas when it comes to cooperation that we have for the Russian Federation, and I believe that is the sort of general sentiment among the Arctic Council countries. This works quite well. They are very comfortable with this kind of intergovernmental setting and obligations that they adhere to.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to shoot to the end of the table now, and over to you, Patrick.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Bonjour. Ou de la coute. thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this panel. So you probably wonder, what's an economic development guy doing with a bunch of diplomats? It's perhaps the full extent of my participation here has not been fully revealed, but I am the chair for the senior Arctic officials, the incoming chair for Canada during the upcoming chairmanship. So I hear all the talk about 2015 and people being anxious about being ready. I'm worried about May 15, 2013. So we've got about a month before we take over. So I'm going to change the question a little bit, if you don't mind, because I'd like to talk about what Canada is doing, and I think it'll be helpful as people are thinking about the next couple of years, and also to think about how the U.S. is preparing. I think it's extremely important to get started now, and I know there's a lot of work that's going on. I think that President Crimson made a very compelling case for the value of the Arctic Council and the progression of the Arctic Council over the last number of years. So I won't talk too much about that, except to just a quick reminder that the Arctic Council was created in Ottawa in 1998. I think the first chair was Canada for the first 2 years, and we have been now through the full cycle. So it's kind of coming back home to a certain extent. And we've seen a tremendous evolution over those 16 years and the eight different chairs that we've seen, concluding with the Swedish chair just now. So, and in my view, having had some experience working with the Arctic Council over the last 6 or 7 years, I've seen a significant progression, especially in the last few years, where the Arctic Council has truly become a body where not only do we do good research, good dialogue, good assessment, but we also take action and concrete action to deal with the issues and make policy. And I think, again, that's a really good direction. My actions, my overall directions are coming from Minister Aglukkaq. And so those of you who haven't met Minister Aglukkaq yet, I hope you will, because she is an amazing individual. She is the first Inuk to be a cabinet member in the Government of Canada. She has been Minister of Health, Minister of my department, the Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency, and since last August, Minister responsible for the Arctic Council, with a special mandate from the Prime Minister to take on this role. She has consulted extensively throughout Canada's north and also engaged with international partners to develop our program, and our program has been revealed over the last few months. I like to describe it as the dance of the seven veils. First, very high level in terms of the themes, and then we got into the sub-themes, and then through the SAO, the Arctic Council meetings, we have been getting to a level of granularity that's quite advanced, such that we have about 10 initiatives, specific initiatives, new initiatives that Canada is proposing during its chairmanship. In addition to continuing some of the good work that's been done, led under the Swedes. I will give you the big picture, because if I gave you too much detail, my neighbors to my immediate left might get really upset and may give me a hard time next week when we try to iron out the final details of our program. And this is all being discussed in real time. The important thing is the theme that the minister has, and Canada has adopted, and the minister has been very strongly promoting. And the theme is development for the people of the North. And I think there's some key words there that need to be really thought about and discussed. First of all, we have the word development, so we're not afraid to talk about development. I'm pleased to hear earlier today, again, that's a common theme, that people understand that there is development that's taking place, that will take place in the North, and we have to collectively determine how that development is going to take place. But very importantly, as we talk about for the people of the North, and for our minister, for our government, it's extremely important to remember that there are people who live in the North. They have lived for thousands of years, and they will continue to make the North their home. But they have aspirations. They want to be part of the economy. They want to be part of the solution. They want better education. They want better health outcomes. And therefore, they want to be at the table with the Arctic Council, and they are. Through the support that we have shown for the six permanent participants, the 8 Arctic states do provide that voice, that ability to participate in the decision making. Within that theme, there are 3 sub-themes that have been laid out. One is responsible Arctic resource development. Under that, maybe a couple of comments. One directly linked to the question early on, the issue of oil and gas development and under what conditions it's going to take place is a very important one. The Arctic Council, under the Swedish leader chairmanship, has made some significant progress here. We have now a new binding instrument that we hope will be formally ratified in Kiruna with respect to response to oil and gas spills. We've got research that's been done in terms of best practices, in terms of standards, and in the various jurisdictions. Canada would like to take that one step further, and we will make prevention of oil spills one of our major priorities, and again, looking at some concrete actions that we may be able to take during our chair in that area. Within the this sub-theme as well, we have been talking about this concept of creating a circumpolar business forum. And we feel that there is a bit of a gap, or there is a voice that has not always been heard as loudly at Arctic Council, and that's the voice of industry and the voice of business. We'd like to bring them into the tent, bring them into the discussions, and we think that the creation of this forum, this kind of a forum, will be well received, a forum that will be designed for business by business, and it will be in the orbit of the Arctic Council, if I can say, but it will not be formally enshrined within the Arctic Council. The other two sub-themes, safe Arctic shipping, again, we've heard quite a lot from previous panelists, and that certainly is an issue that there's a lot of concern and work that needs to be done. And the third sub-team is sustainable circumpolar communities. So again, coming back to the people, and there we want to work collectively on tackling some of the tough issues that our communities in the North face, including making sure that we give full respect. I was very pleased to hear the comments by the former panel that at the end of the day there are traditional practices that still occupy a very important place in the lives of northern people. I think we've seen some data recently that what we call country foods in northern Canada, caribou, char, et cetera, occupy sometimes as much as 30% of the diet for northerners, for Aboriginal people in the north. So it's extremely important. But we also have to make place at the Arctic Council, and we have to a certain extent, but we can do better for traditional knowledge. And that should be as important as scientific knowledge in terms of coming up with some of the policy, some of the responses in terms of what's going on in the north. I will conclude by just emphasizing a few other things that we want to achieve during our chair, and these are issues that we've already discussed with our colleagues, but there is certainly a need for greater coordination and continuing to improving the efficiencies and the working within the Arctic Council. We have working groups, and sometimes we need to ensure better dialogue and work between the expert groups, the task forces. We have taken some important steps by establishing a permanent secretariat in Tromsø now, so we will have something to build on, a little bit more stability there, but I think there's more work to be done there. We certainly want to see how we can enhance the participation, the role, the profile of the permanent participants within the council itself, but again, at the working groups, within the task forces as well. We want to make sure that there's strong follow-up and tracking back to previous assessments, previous work that the council has undertaken, and that, again, we're constantly thinking about, okay, what kind of action, what kind of specific concrete results do we want to achieve through this work? We can do a lot better in the area of communications and outreach. And you know, I'm a bit ashamed sometimes when I'm traveling in the north and I'm talking to people. I'm talking to sometimes some business leaders or some Aboriginal leaders, and they ask me, say, can you tell me what this Arctic Council is all about? And I think that that's just not acceptable after 16 years. We can do a much better job. And again, reaching right into communities. We've done it before in other areas in the north. I think we can do a much better job there. And of course, we realize that the Arctic Council doesn't function in a vacuum, that we are part of an international community. And in fact, some of the successes of the past, including the work on persistent organic pollutants and reducing those and the incidence of those into the country foods that I talked about earlier, progress there was only possible because we did the proper handoff. We did the work, did the policy, the research, and then we handed it off to the right UN agency to be able to have an instrument that then would apply across the world. And we're seeing the positive results there. So that will also apply to working on a polar shipping code, for example, working with IMO. And there are other areas as well where we will have to ensure that there's some strong collaboration. And the last comment I would like to say is, of course, working with our friends and colleagues from the U.S., because we have an opportunity here during the next 4 years to ensure that there's good cohesion, good handoff, good even planning in advance of some of our initiatives so that if we don't quite get it done in 2 years, we know we'll have a partner who will be happy to take on and finish the work. So we're very pleased to be working with the U.S. and, again, helping, if any way we can, helping you also get ready for 2015. Thank you.
Just to pick you up on this point about the relationship between the Council and the broader international system, specifically on energy governance issues, how do you see that relationship evolving? We have, in energy, a set of governance arrangements that are in fluid, in transition, that don't reach many of the energy consumers and producers. How is the Arctic Council, as a new player in the energy field, handling that?
Well, I did address, to a certain extent, the work that's been done during the last chair, the concluding chair, and indicate that Canada certainly, and again, this is subject to working out the details with our partners, we do want to make oil and gas spill prevention a priority during our chair. But I also want to recognize that when you talk about oversight, we have to recognize that we have regulatory regimes in place within our jurisdictions that do meet some pretty high standards. That's part of the work that we're doing also is comparing our standards and how they apply in different jurisdictions. And we have oil-producing countries. We have others that are still at the very early stage. In Canada, after the Macondo incident, we did a full review of our regulatory regime in the north. We were pressured by the multinational companies to relax some of the requirements, and we said no. We were not prepared to do it at this time. It may well lead to some delays in terms of drilling in the offshore for Canada, but at the end of the day, we feel that safety, security issues have to prevail, and there is more research, more technology development that's required. And those of you who are familiar, we have a same season relief well requirement in Canada, and we're not prepared to let go of that requirement until such time as we can see a demonstration that an alternative approach can achieve the same protection, the same results. So it may mean a little bit of a slowdown for Canada, for example, although on the onshore we do have some really interesting opportunities in the Mackenzie Valley, which we're also pursuing.
Thank you. Ambassador, over to you.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you very much also for the introduction. And the thing about the romantic title, I'm actually the Arctic Ambassador of the Kingdom of Denmark, so I represent all the three parties of the Kingdom of Denmark, Greenland, and the Faroe Islands. You had three questions, and so I have sort of three answers or three clusters of remarks. Now, the first one about what we have learned from the past regarding the Arctic Council. Now, I really worked in many organizations like the WTO, the EU, of course, the OECD, and all that, but I've never experienced such close relationship between diplomats as in the Arctic Council. It actually went so far as to becoming a little bit physical last week when we went together to the North Pole, standing there with the other senior Arctic officials at the North Pole. We actually hugged each other, and there was this atmosphere of a very close relationship, which is also what has brought us very far in the Arctic Council in terms of the concrete results that we have obtained. And I'm sure that other parts, other regions of the world could learn a lot from this, the South Chinese Sea, for instance, by this very close cooperation and the way that we actually deal with the concrete problems that we have. Example, we have entered now into two agreements. One is the search and rescue agreement, which was signed in Nuuk in 2011, and the one we're going to sign in Kiruna on oil spill. Very good concrete steps. What we need to do now is to make them operational. And the Kingdom of Denmark's integrated Arctic Command in Nuuk organized an exercise last year where we went through a situation of a shipping incident out of the coast, east coast of Greenland, and learned a lot. And we are also going to do the next drill within the Arctic Council in this field. But there might be a point that we share this responsibility of organizing the drills among ourselves so that it will not only be one country who does that. We should also have drills on oil spill or even integrated exercises with search and rescue situations where there is an oil spill, because these two things can easily go together. So what we learned from the Arctic Council cooperation is this fantastic friendship, which we should use further on in the future to obtain concrete results. Now, what is then the role of the Arctic Council? And if you look a little bit ahead, now, a main point is to keep the Arctic discussion there at the Arctic Council. And in this respect, I would like to address the observer issue. There's no doubt that although the Arctic Council is a regional organization, there's not one issue which doesn't have a global impact, meaning an impact on a country far away. We have the Northern Sea Route, which have an impact on Singapore. We have oil and gas has an impact on the Middle East, fisheries on Spain, minerals on Africa, strategic minerals on China, and so on. So what we do has an impact on others. But we have to turn this around also and look at the impact that other countries' behavior has on us. For instance, the Chinese or China's pollution has a huge impact on climatic factors in the Arctic, black carbon, the acidification of the oceans. We see the consequences very strongly in the Arctic. So I think, and the Kingdom of Denmark thinks, that we should do our utmost to solve the observer's problem at the next meeting. I think we are about to make a huge mistake in leaving important powers out. And now I'm talking about the country applicants and the EU. These are international players who we need to have not as a member of the Arctic Council, but whose points of view we need in the Arctic Council, and we need them as close to us as possible in order to take into account the positions of these important players. And the risk is that if we don't take them on board, they will go elsewhere and make alternative fora. The final question was the relationship between members and the PP, and that sort of cluster of issues, if you want. Now, in the forefront of the Arctic strategies of the members of the Arctic Council is the people living in the Arctic. Former Premier Kubi Kleist mentioned that there are 4 million people in the Arctic area, and 350 of those are indigenous peoples. There is a process of devolution. Historically, this process can only go one way. It will be stronger, and also, as Kubi Kleist said, people want to be masters in their own house. They want to decide for themselves, and the development will go in that direction. Now, I'm perfectly aware that the legal basis for what we're doing in the Arctic Council is the Ottawa Declaration, which states, of course, who is a member of the Arctic Council and so on. But I want to say that I think we should be pragmatic, that we have to look at the representation of these territories and these people at the Arctic Council, so that we ensure that there is the proper representation of these participants in our deliberations. Otherwise, also there, I think we are in for a huge historic mistake. Thank you.
One very brief follow-up to that, and then I'll be coming to the floor. I mean, Alice said at the beginning that the Arctic was a great untold strategic story, but I think, as you've made clear, it's also a great untold diplomatic story. But these very close relationships are formed in a tight, tightly bounded body with a small number of participants. Thank you. Okay. A small number of participants who get to know each other very well and build a high level of shared awareness. Do you think that level of cooperation and that level of knowledge of each other can be maintained if the council continues to become a larger and more complex body?
Well, this has a lot to do of how you physically organize the meetings, actually. But the way we do it in the Arctic Council, it's quite simple, actually, because there's an inner circle of us here, the friends here at the Arctic Council, and the permanent participants. And we are the ones negotiating. So I don't really care about how many we have, you know, as backbenchers in the room. We do the meetings in strange places, by the way, very often in Arctic cities, but all these cities have a gymnasium, which is normally big enough, or a sports facility, which is big enough to host these people. So, I mean, I don't really buy this, well, there's no room for them, or how can we accommodate 100 people in the room? Of course we can do that. I'm not afraid that we have to share everything with the observers, because every time we want to be sort of private or want to discuss a juicy political item, we actually go informal. We either have an informal meeting or a meal, and then we discuss the things directly between us. I don't see any practical or political problems by taking on board the observers, on the contrary.
Right, I'm going to open it up to the floor now. There was a gentleman over on the side there who was very quick with his hand, and then a lady over there.
Thank you each very much. Richard Ranger from the American Petroleum Institute, and I'm going to ask you all a variation of the same question I asked Lieutenant Governor Treadwell and Deputy Secretary Hayes. Particularly, Ambassador Holm, you spoke about devolution and the importance of the indigenous peoples of the North being masters in their own house. There are 8 Arctic nations. I'm not sure I can count the numbers of Arctic indigenous nations and cultures that are represented. I imagine it's a number of 50 or 60. I'm not disagreeing with the premise, but I'm asking how you carry out representation, because the Inuk cannot represent the Inupiat, and they can't represent the Chukotka. The different peoples, if they are entitled to their own representation, there is a structure that does not yet exist to accomplish that, and I'm wondering what your vision is for that in the future and how that relates to the sovereign representation of the 8 Arctic nations. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take one more question, and then we'll do them both together. The lady over on the side there.
Good morning. My name is Reba Carruth. I am a professor at Georgetown University. I teach a class on transatlantic and UN global climate change cooperation. I have a quick question, a two-part question. As you probably know, there's a pending transatlantic free trade area that will extensively converge markets and industry and regulatory systems transatlantically with standards. We currently have transatlantic regulatory cooperation frameworks in place. We have a transatlantic business council, so on and so forth. I'm just curious how the Arctic region will be integrated into this unfolding transatlantic regulatory harmonization and industry standards process. We also, by the way, have a transatlantic legislators dialogue, so that might be useful for the Arctic Council and the Arctic peoples. The other question, coming back to our distinguished guest from Denmark, Ambassador Holm, is what is going to happen with China and India as observers at the Arctic Council? Is there a plan just to sort of have them as observers that talk about problems emanating from those regions, or is there, I mean, I'm just curious about that, because we had speakers from the Embassy of Denmark and the EPA, and they brought this up, so that was one thing. The other thing is, lastly, what about this, there was some type of Far East free trade area that was talked about back in the late 90s with Russia and Japan and Siberia, and I just don't know where that stands and how the Arctic fits into that, so.
Many thanks. Okay. Did you want to go first?
Yeah, I can start. There was a question on how to organize work among ourselves in a scenario with more independence for the Arctic territories or the territories that are actually situated in the Arctic. Now, we fully respect that the basis for our work is the Ottawa Declaration, and as long as this is the basis for our work, we will respect it fully. So I will now speak for how we will organize ourselves within the Kingdom of Denmark. We speak with one voice. We coordinate among the three parts of the kingdom before the meetings, so you won't experience any disagreement among the within the Kingdom of Denmark delegation at the meetings. But since we have a very advanced self-government legislation in place for Greenland, for instance, which is a dynamic piece of legislation transferring still more competence areas from Copenhagen to Greenland, it's very obvious that the consequence will be that Greenland will have an increasing say, if you want, within the Kingdom of Denmark delegation. And this is simply the way historically this is going to go. And it's inevitable. It's going to happen like this, and we will have to take the necessary political decisions because there are consequences of this. And the next question was, what is China and India actually going to do in the Arctic Council? Well, it's not only to sit in at our senior official meetings. What I see as the most important contribution would be a participation in the various working parties and task force that we have, meaning that the points of views and the knowledge of these delegations could give some added value to the work of the Arctic Council. So I see it as a very concrete initiative that they will come aboard as observers, not because they're sitting and listening to, quite frankly, sometimes boring discussions, but because they can give some input into the work of the working parties and task force in the Arctic Council.
Thanks very much. I would like to follow up on what Klaus said now and also address a couple of issues that have come up. First, and there are 8 member states of the Arctic Council, as you all know. But why are there these 8? Well, they have, particularly the 5 littoral states, of course, have particular rights and obligations and responsibilities under the Convention of Law of the Sea. So that's why they are apart from any observer nation or observer state that might come along. It's important to keep that in mind as well, which is in line with the Ottawa Declaration of 1996. And then I understand what you've just said, Klaus, on the composition of the viewpoints of Denmark, that we'll have to bear in mind the various viewpoints of Denmark and Greenland as well. But let's keep in mind then the separate questions, I mean the permanent, the member states, the full member states, and the permanent observers, the different difference between the two. Secondly, David, I enjoyed your chess comparison at the very start. I think you're absolutely right. That is one of the main functions of an intergovernmental body such as the Arctic Council. In 2011, we decided upon a search and rescue commitment under the Arctic Council. Then at Kiruna, we will hopefully decide on an oil spill preparedness agreement, which adds then, exactly as you pointed out, adds to the complexity and the operationality of the Arctic Council, which is a good thing. Thirdly, The permanent secretariat that is now being established in Tromsø, in the Arctic Norwegian territory, in the part of northern Norway, I think that's a great thing, a permanent secretariat. Up until now, that has been the responsibility of the chairmanship or the chairman in office to have the secretariat or, assisting the Arctic Council. Now we will try to build a small, but still a permanent secretariat headed by an Icelandic senior official. I think it was you, Patrick, that raised the question, is the Arctic Council well known? Is it in need of public relations? On the one hand, perhaps it is. On the other hand, I'm not quite sure. When you look at the interest among so many nation states around the world, also very far from the Arctic, it seems that we've done a pretty good job at it. Or perhaps the Arctic has done that job itself. But nevertheless, it seems to be... I'm surprised from time to time by the fact that it is so well known, and also that the ramifications of the Arctic Council and the legal foundations are so well known. And that is a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing.
Patrick, you wanted to come in.
Okay. A couple of comments. I'm not sure if I can answer your questions, but I will try to address the Indigenous participation. And I also want to talk about devolution a little bit, because... Canada has been going through a process of devolution with its northern territories as well. So the territories don't have the same status as the provinces. This is a constitutional issue. But we have devolved over time most of the same authorities and responsibilities to the three territories. We are now in the process of final agreement on devolution of responsibilities for lands and resources for the Northwest Territories. And we are in early negotiations for Nunavut for the same. So we see this as a normal and, again, an inevitable process that we will continue to increase self-determination. And within the Northern Territories, we also have land claim agreements, which I could speak of at length, because I think it's a very novel approach, a very modern approach to be able to empower Aboriginal people within the framework of Canada's Constitution. And, again, the participation at the Arctic Council is a federal lead responsibility. This is an international body, and we welcome the participation of territorial governments, but they do it within the framework of Canada's role abroad. So we are working, for example, with our territorial governments to identify some very specific areas where they may want to co-lead on some of the initiatives. So they certainly want their input. We want them active at the working groups if there's an area that they can contribute. But again, Canada will speak as one at the Arctic Council. The Indigenous participation, the question that was raised, I think there are six permanent participants, as you know. Each one of them has governance, a constitution, has a democratic process to be able to represent its membership. And so it's up to them to determine how they are going to be able to speak on behalf of their people, and it's up to them to determine also how they are going to relate back to their people with respect to the Arctic Council or other priorities. And again, I would look to an organization like the Inuit Circumpolar Organization, ICC, as being very sophisticated, having achieved a lot of progress over the years and having made pretty significant contributions to the Arctic Council. But again, I'm only looking at one of them, the Sami. All the others also have very strong institutions to be able to represent their membership. Thank you.
Julie, did you want to come in?
Thank you. I would just add to what Patrick said that it's probably actually a better question for the next panel, but the Indigenous peoples in the Arctic do have these six NGOs that represent them in the Arctic Council, and they, of course, all Indigenous peoples across the Arctic have different interests, so it's not always easy or maybe even possible for all of the Indigenous peoples to speak with one voice, but certainly they have organized themselves for participation in the council, and there's even an Indigenous People Secretariat in Copenhagen, which also helps to organize and strengthen the role of the permanent participants in the council. There's of course also the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous issues in the UN, which I don't know enough about that entity to know how much they discuss Arctic specific Indigenous issues, but perhaps some of the next speakers can address that. On the questions from Professor Carruth, I think it still remains to be seen how the transatlantic free trade agreement will incorporate Arctic issues, or if it will. I suspect it probably will, given that economic development is so important in the Arctic and all parts of the Arctic. I think it, certainly the discussions are going to happen there, and we'll see how that goes. I actually was not aware of the long ago discussion about the Far East FTA back in the 90s. So I can't really speak to that, but that's or whether that would have incorporated any Arctic sorts of issues, given that at the time it was discussed, presuming it was a while back, the Asian countries weren't so interested in the Arctic as they are now. So I don't have much to say about that. But with respect to China and India and some of the other countries that are interested in getting in, certainly all of the state observers and the ones that are seeking to come in. We've now, of course, defined a role for them as of the new ministerial 2 years ago, and we hope that the current set and the ones that will come in will participate most actively at the working group level, which is where the real action in the council happens anyway. It's where the technical work, the scientific work, the projects, the assessments we do happens, and we in the United States very much value the contributions of the observers, especially when they have particular expertise that can help all of us better understand how the Arctic works. So we'll see what happens as to who comes in, all or some or none, in a few weeks. But certainly the participation of the observers is very important. And we all very much value it and hope that it will continue to be a valuable contribution that they'll make to this forum to continue to make it stronger over time.
Christian wants to come in.
Thanks so much for letting me take the floor again. On the ambitions for the transatlantic free trade agreement, on the European side, of course, that will be negotiated by the European Union. Norway is not a member of the European Union, neither is Iceland, neither is, of course, Russia. So that's one part of the challenges. The other part is that Norway, my government, will be looking into how we could align ourselves with such a future agreement in order to keep up the level playing field. Thank you.
Right, I'm going to answer more questions. There's a gentleman right at the back there. The guy down here.
Thank you very much. My name is John Topping. I'm with the Climate Institute here in Washington.
Can you hold the mic slightly close to your mouth?
I'm sorry. John Topping with the Climate Institute in Washington. The Arctic Council has done some superb work on short-life climate forcers. In 2011, you issued an extraordinary report that it would commend to people. And the science tends to indicate that roughly two-thirds or so of the warming over the last several decades has been associated with short-life climate forcers, black carbon compounds that produce tropospheric ozone, et cetera. There are a couple opportunity areas that perhaps might be open immediately, perhaps either by Arctic Council countries or perhaps even through the Arctic Council.
Sir, can you just pull the mic to your mouth?
Oh, I'm sorry. One would be airline overflight. Since 1998, there have been when Russia permitted airlines to fly over, I think we now have something like 47,000 flights going over. They appear to be a substantial factor. Professor Jacobson of Stanford recently did a paper suggesting modest rerouting of the flights at very small cost, less than 1% in terms of fuel costs, et cetera, could make a sizable difference. A second would be in energy development projects within the Arctic. Much of focus recently on the pipeline issue in Keystone has been over the additional CO2 that would be associated. But if in energy projects generally we were to go to essentially almost a zero tolerance standard in terms of soot emissions that would be associated with auxiliary vehicles, no methane releases, et cetera, across the board, that could make a huge difference. And I wonder whether the Arctic Council countries would see that might be appropriate for consideration by the Arctic Council.
Thank you. The gentleman in the front there.
Thank you to the panelists. My name is Shea. I'm a student at American University here in Washington, and I wanted to ask about the search and search and rescue agreement that was signed in 2011, and what that might indicate about the evolution of the Arctic Council as an institution, because it is the first legally binding agreement. And I understand there's also deliberations about an oil spill preparedness agreement. The Arctic Council is typically described as a soft law organization, which potentially enhances the role for non-state actors and indigenous groups. But there seems to be a growing discourse about the formalization of the Arctic Council as an institution with more legal authority. So I'm curious about the perspectives of the panelists on what direction the Arctic Council seems to be heading and what this might imply for the different interests and stakeholders that are involved.
Okay, I've been told from the back that we have another 5 minutes for this session. So if the panelists could be quite brief on these, then we'll try and get like one more question.
Should I start with the agreements? Because I was so lucky that I attended the SAR exercise right after the signing of it. Well, that was last year. We had this SAR exercise out of the East Coast of Greenland, as I mentioned in my introduction. Now, it was was a beautiful day, and a Danish marine vessel was called the Arctic Victorious, something like that, and that caught a fire, and there was this drill, we tried to move people around. And the whole thing was just so illustrative, because it showed very clearly how difficult it is to evacuate people in a meaningful way. The cynical way of putting this is that we might be able to, if you look at a cruiser ship, to save people from dying somewhere and to take them somewhere else where they will die because of the distances and the climate and the lack of money and people and equipment and so on. So it's both this agreement and the oil spill agreement, they're very tiny first steps. They're important steps, though, because it organizes the division of labor between the member countries, but we are far from being there yet. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of resources to make these two agreements even more efficient and better and make sure that they can save life and prevent pollution.
Julie?
On the first question, whether the Arctic countries would go to zero emissions on black carbon and methane, certainly that would be great, but the Council is not a regulatory body, as Ambassador Holm just said. But we are doing this work on short-lived climate forcers, and it is resulting in recommendations to the member states to take action domestically on these things. And so we hope that that all eight of us will do that. I don't know that we'd ever reach zero emissions, but ideally that'd be great. But the Council certainly prioritizes short-lived climate forcers as a major issue, and the U.S. in particular is pushing very hard to take as much action as we can. On the agreements, the Council is a sort of a soft law body. It's by design. It's an intergovernmental forum. The two agreements that have been signed the SAR agreement is now in force, and the other one will be signed soon, are not Arctic Council agreements. They are agreements among the Arctic states, and the Arctic states were convened by the Council to negotiate these agreements. It's a fine distinction. It's a little bit subtle, but these are not Arctic Council agreements. The Council does not have the authority to take on legally binding commitments. Whether that'll change in the future, it's hard to say, but there certainly is a view in the United States about international organizations and regulatory bodies internationally that isn't so favorable to moving the Council in that direction. I don't know that would change anytime soon. And we like the forum the way it is. It's very effective. And I don't think we in the U.S. government right now see a strong argument for changing it into something stronger. And, of course, it depends on what you mean by stronger. But if it means turning it into some sort of regulatory body, I don't see that as something the U.S. would support anytime soon.
Yeah, I think I would echo those views. I don't think that we're talking about revising or reviewing the mandate of the Arctic Council, but I think within that mandate, there's still scope to improve our effectiveness or efficiency. So there's work that's been done that will actually lead to better results. And I think, again, we've demonstrated over the last few years that it can be a body that leads to some concrete actions, policy
policymaking, not just dialogue and assessments or review of results of research. But again, just a reminder that there are 8 Arctic states here, and we all have jurisdiction. We're all exercising our jurisdiction. There is no vacuum in jurisdiction. And so, therefore, we don't see the need for to step up the role of the Arctic Council to fill any type of void or vacuum of that nature.
The search and rescue agreement under the umbrella of the Arctic Council, signed at Nuuk in 2011, enormously important first step. That shows that the Arctic Council can be used as the correct forum in order to negotiate such agreements. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take one final question. It has to be a short one. And the lady at the back there.
Hi, good morning. I'm Yijing, a former intern with Brookings. So my question is, it seems natural and interesting to see the air of friendly cooperation in the Arctic Council. And yet it's also a little bit surprising to me because given the imbalance of the distribution of natural resources, for example, 70% of natural gas reserves tend to stay in Russia. And so I wonder if that's a factor that stays at the back of your mind when you define your natural interests and the interaction among those countries. Thanks.
Well, I don't think energy itself is going to be disruptive to the relationships among the Arctic states or change the Arctic Council, really. It's all of the countries manage their own domestic energy policies and make their own decisions about how they're going to manage their natural resources. So I don't really see that changing. I know there's a lot of speculation in the media and other places that conflict could erupt in the Arctic over oil and gas, given that oil and gas resources, or at least oil resources in the world, are thought to be diminishing at some point. But I think that's not true. None of the Arctic states believe that would happen. And I don't think that the oil situation in the Arctic is any different than any other part of the world. It will play out as it does, and Russia will do what it's going to do with its resources, just as we will and the other countries will. So I don't really think that's an issue that would affect the Council or the relationships among the Arctic states per se, although it could affect relationships between the Arctic states and other countries down the road.
And again, the Arctic Council is a consensus making body, and so there's an equal voice for all at the table, including for the indigenous permanent participants.
I take issue with the premise of your question, ma'am, because nobody questions Russia's the resources of Russia, that they are under the jurisdiction of the Russian Federation. The legal order is there, the framework is there. So consequently, I'm not quite sure. I understand your question, but on the other hand, I'm not quite sure if I agree with your question. Thank you.
Ambassador, the last word is yours.
No, I mean, we all are different in the Arctic Council, and of course, oil, gas, energy is very important to Russia. I think that the calculation is that 30% of the Russian GDP in a very few years' time will come from the Arctic area. So we all go to the Arctic Council, into the meetings and the work of the Arctic Council with different point of departures. So I don't see that there is any political problem in the fact that we are different as concerns energy or minerals or Denmark being a shipping nation or a maritime shipping nation. So we all come with our different point of departures.
Okay, I'd like to thank you all for your questions and thank the panelists for their responses. I think we're hearing about a body that's at an actually absolutely crucial stage of its development, and I wish you all much luck in the coming years as you take the Council forward. We're going to break now for around 10 minutes, so please come back as quickly as possible. We've got almost certainly the most important panel of the day to finish on a high. So thank you very much. Thank you.